This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
What are the differences between religion, magic, and spirituality? Over time, these categories have been articulated in a variety of ways across differing cultures. However, many assume that multiple understandings are merely derivative of Western assertions about secular modernity. In The Modern Spirit of Asia, the Spiritual and the Secular in China and India, Peter van der Veer explores how Chinese and South Asians interpreted Western discourses about religion and spirituality. Through his work, he demonstrates that cross-cultural comparison provides us with a complex interactional history, where non-Western participants shape their own visions of society, nation, and self, often in dialogue with Westerners, but not dependent on them. In our conversation, we discuss scholarly conceptualizations of Asian traditions, secularism, European imperialism, Mohandas Gandhi, nationalism, modern interpretations of Buddhism and Taoism, Christian missionaries, political spirituality, religious minorities in the state, and Chinese and Indian modernities. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Peter van der Veer. Joining me today is Peter van der Veer, and he's here to speak to us about The Modern Spirit of Asia, the Spiritual and the Secular in China and India, one of his many new books. He's very busy, so thank you for joining us, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. So
as is our tradition here at New Books in Religion, we usually start with a little background on you. So if you could tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the study of religion more broadly, perhaps influential mentors or moments in your life that have really been substantial in either the approach you take or in the questions you're asking, how did this all start for you?
Yeah, I think I may not have been initially very interested in religion. I was interested in linguistics and in philosophy in high school. But I went to India after high school, which a lot of people of my generation did. So hitchhiking and taking the magic bus from Istanbul to Kabul and Pakistan to Delhi, just to see the world. And so I traveled for several months in India and Nepal and was struck by how little I knew about the history of India and the history of the entire region I traveled through, and how important religion was in these areas. So I was born in the early 50s, and religion had become less central in Europe than, or in Western Europe, than it had been before. Although the Netherlands were still, where I was born, were still rather religious. So Holland was at that time called a pillarized society. So religion did play a role, but people of my generation just wanted to get rid of it. So it's not that we were so deeply interested in religion, saw it as something that was slowly disappearing in Western Europe. But on my trip to India, I just discovered that this was not true for the rest of the world, or at least for that world I was traveling in. And Islam was obviously very important in Iran. That was still Iran under the Shah. That we are talking now about, I think, something like 1973, or 1972, 1973. And in Pakistan, Islam was very important. And in India, they had a very strange set of practices, which were called Hinduism, but I couldn't quite figure it out. I didn't understand what was going on there. So I came back to Holland with a idea that there was a whole world that was quite fascinating and in which religion played a central role. So I decided to combine my interest in linguistics and philosophy with the interest in India, started with studying Sanskrit, and then also added Hindi, a modern Indian language, to it. And then basically figured out that for understanding in the Indian civilization, something we call now religion was quite central. And then I went back to India doing field work and so on and so forth. So then basically it went in that direction. But not a kind of initial curiosity about what religion was, but rather a experience during a trip as a young student going to a world that he was completely unaware of.
Now, you've written a lot, especially on South Asia, some very influential books. Where do you see this project kind of falling into the trajectory of your larger research? How did this project emerge from your previous work, and how did you start to see this coming together as a book?
I became interested in comparison in an earlier book, The Imperial Encounter, which looked at Britain in the 19th century and India in the 19th century, and as its major argument that there is an interaction between, say, the colonial metropole and the colony, which configures what we call religion and also nationalism in these two places that are connected through imperialism. So that was already a project on comparison between Europe and an Asian country. And I got into this through students that we had at the University of Amsterdam, where I was teaching, from a shaman in Fujian in southern China, who basically told me that what I was teaching them about religion and nationalism in Europe and in India was not applicable to China. They said, well, we have solved the problem of religion already in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And basically, you will not find this kind of political significance of religion and so on in China. So I was getting very curious about this place and went to it at their invitation. And, well, the first thing which then struck me in Xiamen, where I went, that the university is a university that was built at the beginning of the 20th century, was built right next to a very major temple, Nanputo, and a Buddhist temple, a huge Buddhist monastery, in fact, which had been a teaching academy for many centuries. And later I discovered that it was, in the 20th century, one of the major places for development of modern kind of practical Buddhism or engaged Buddhism. And so these students were just saying nonsense, in fact, because their own university had been definitely planted next to this seed of learning that had been there for centuries. And then when I was a little bit kind of exploring the area, this is it's on the ocean side, so there you have fishing villages. And these fishing villages were full of little shrines for, say, the goddess Matsu and so on. Fishermen in that entire area worship that, which looks very much like the worship of Hindu goddesses, and has actually, in many ways, it looks very similar in terms of ritual practices and how these images look and so on. So I thought, well, this is interesting. You have this intellectual class that is denying something with this at their doorstep, and let me figure this out for a while. And then I thought maybe I can write a book on comparing India, which I knew quite well by then, and China, which I didn't know at all, and see whether these two cases of actually civilizations that are next to each other can highlight some issues in either of them that are not being highlighted in the research that is specialized on them. Because I have this idea that comparing gives you some possibility of finding things which are normally not deeply discussed in the literature that is specialized on one of these areas. I didn't, of course, quite realize how idiotically big this was. So... Now, of course, this is total hubris, but definitely I learned a lot from it. And but that's how it came about. Actually, again, through seemingly these things all happen with me through experiences that I have. It's not that I have an intellectual plan that is from some abstract set of ideas that I want to explore, but more through encounters of moments that I see certain things and then think, well, I have to look into it a little bit more.
Now, for the book, one of the central strings that runs throughout it is this relationship between categories, and specifically the categories religion, magic, secularity, and spirituality. Can you talk a little bit about how you're considering these terms, these categories, and how it structures the remainder of the book?
Yeah. Let me start with the discovery that I made when I read Talal Asad's work in the beginning. Did a few pieces on Christian monasticism and so on. That's how I first read him. But then he published this Genealogies of Religion and made a very interesting case about, say, how this concept of religion had a particular history within Europe, in Christian history, and that it was universalized over worlds in which that category did not actually play the same role. And so that's where basically my thinking about these things started, that you've got to figure out that Hinduism and also for China, Taoism, that these are all terms that are that you have to be using very carefully, and that the concept of religion in both India and China is very, very recent, basically second half of the 19th century. That is not to say that these traditions are not old, of course. Obviously, these traditions are very old, and they have been real traditions in the sense that there are real debates between people about correct practices and correct beliefs and not correct beliefs and so on. So my interest also in earlier work was already in how through imperialism and through the encounter with the West, these concepts are made that people have to respond to, and then really they think about their own practices in new terms, or using new terms. So the term religion for China is a new thing, and it becomes an issue that, and for India also, and becomes a thing they people reflect on. And then they try to say something about the relation between the society in which they live and this religion. So what is then the religious core of their civilization? Now, Hinduism becomes then for a number of thinkers the core of their civilization, and sometimes Taoism or what is called Chinese religion becomes the core of Chinese civilization, but more importantly, Confucianism becomes the core of Chinese civilization. Now, when that happens, when that intellectual move is made, then these intellectuals in India and China also want to defend what their religion is and their religious civilization is against say missionaries and imperial thinkers that think that their civilizations are backward and should actually be changed. To some extent, they also take that over, of course, that because they see a certain kind of backwardness in the fact that they have been defeated in many ways by Western power. And they blame their civilizations and their religions for that. So they want to create a religion that is comparable to Christianity and that is defensible. And one of the moves that is made in many of these religions is to get rid of superstitious, magical practices. Now, that is, of course, a difficult thing to do. But this idea of some practices being magical and the superstition of the masses, that is available, well, in Europe and in India and in China, and it becomes kind of, it's marshaled for the transformation of what is seen as respectable religion in these places. So you have a more respectable Confucianism, you have the respectable Hinduism. You have, of course, Taoism, which is very hard to get rid of these magical practices, but you can emphasize more a textual Taoism and so forth. Also, for Buddhism, these things happen. So it's modernized, as it were. And then you have another phenomenon that happens at the same time, which says that there are ways of thinking about the world that are not to be captured or are not captured by institutional religion, and that are also not entirely captured by a secular worldview. And it is it's a kind of universalism that comes up both in in Europe among people who, are interested in spirituality, and in the United States among transcendentalists and a whole range of people who are interested in the wisdom of the East, but at the same time interested in poetry and so on, who do not want to stick to organized religion, and so therefore do not want to follow Hindu priest or Catholic priest and so on, but want to take from all these different streams of what they would call spiritual wisdom a whole universal spirituality. In that interplay, the East is a source of wisdom. And then finally, you have, of course, the idea of the secular, which is a very complex idea, but it's an idea that religions can be a private affair, but should not enter the public sphere, and definitely should not have scientific claims. And the idea that there is the possibility in a space for religious beliefs in the private sphere, but that the public sphere should be entirely cleansed from religious influences is a very strong set of ideas which you find in major political movements all over the world. So also in India and China. Now, my argument is that these things, these different concepts, religion, magic, the spiritual and the secular, cannot be studied and understood on their own. They form a chain, you could say, that are deeply connected to each other. And when you start moving on one side, something else is happening on the other side. So what you see is a whole fulcrum of thought that centers around these four concepts.
Now, you cover a lot of ground in this book, and we certainly won't be able to explore it all. But you begin by thinking about, while spirituality is this cultural category developed primarily in the West, you examine how Asians interpret Western discourses about spirituality. Can you tell us a little bit about how this happened in India and China?
Yeah. So there is this idea that one does not want to have institutional religion, but one wants to have influx from or influence from the wisdom of the East, and that is very strong in Europe and America in the second half of the 19th century, even in the beginning of the 20th century, and so people are really interested in the books of the East, and so on. You get publications, you get translations from Eastern, what is then called also Eastern philosophy. All these are new things, in fact, and people in the colonized areas, and China is not colonized, but stands under very strong imperial influence. People in India and China read what the people outside of these societies are writing about them, and what the knowledge formation is about their civilizations, and they also participate then in it, not only as informants and so on, but as intellectuals in their own right, and try to figure out what in the modern world their civilizations can contribute to their nationalism, to forming an idea of a national pride and national culture. They want to contribute to a universal civilization. So this is a major issue. For example, in India, one of the major figures is a guy called Swami Vivekananda. He goes to the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in the 1890s and brings this message from India as a teacher of spiritual wisdom to the West. And in doing so, he also transforms the understanding of religious traditions, especially yoga, in India itself. So it's a double move, as it were. It's a presentation, a representation of India to outsiders, but then it also changes what is the understanding of the traditions in India itself. And also, that same thing is happening, in fact, in China, not so clear and so strong as in India, because India is colonized, and the English language becomes a major language in India, whereas China has a much more, a much stronger resistance against against this. So China is a very double move, as it were. On the one hand, keeping these Western influences and especially the language out, and at the same time trying to conform to Western ideas about science and modernity. So you find in China also spiritual leaders who take over this idea of universal wisdom and China's contribution to it, but they are not as prominent as in India because of the particular history of imperialism.
Now, the role of Western scholarship also played a formative part in constructing these categories, especially the categories of religion and world religion. And you trace some of these genealogies. And I was wondering, just to kind of give us an idea of kind of how academics or Orientalists or scholars played in shaping notions of religion. What would you say is the impact of European modernity on the conceptualizations of Asian traditions? And you give us an example from Max Müller and James Legge, but you also give us a snapshot of the Dutch scholarship, and perhaps since that's your background, that might be something that would be extremely valuable for listeners, this Dutch example of scholarship on the construction of these categories.
Yeah. No, I think the this was, of course, an international, like it is today, right? You are an American, I'm a Dutch. It's we are all in conversation with each other. And that was starting in the second half of the 19th century. So Müller, definitely through the Sacred Books of the East and Legge, played a major role in this. But the Dutch were also, the Dutch had a colonial empire. Indonesia was the major element of. And the Dutch had to deal with Islam and with what they call the Hindu-Buddhist layer under Islam, as it were. It is sometimes called Javanese mysticism. You have these ideas still in Clifford Geertz's work on the religion of Java. Bali as a Hindu kingdom. So the Dutch had to rule an area in which Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism were of importance. And it, of course, of major political importance was Islam. And these academics in Holland had to work with the colonial government to get basically knowledge. They were employed by the colonial governments. The major figure is Christian Snoeger-Gronje, who became a major legal authority on Islamic law, who was sent to by the Dutch colonial government to Makkah to study Muslims, especially Muslims from Aceh in Indonesia, in Mecca. And to get into Mecca, he had to convert to Islam. So one of the debates later was whether he had become a real Muslim or not, an unreal Muslim, as it were. So he basically scouted for the Dutch and at the same time produced very major scholarship on Islamic law. And later then became also a colonial agent in suppressing Muslim rebellions or Aceh rebellions, which had a kind of Islamic flavor, or there was a Islamic element in these what they are called the rebellions. So he was advising the military expeditions on how to deal with Aceh. So that's a very clear example of that kind of scholarship. Another one is De Groot, who was the isn't still one of the major sources for our understanding of Taoism, who was sent to Xiamen by the Dutch to study actually the language, so that he could be sent afterwards to Borneo to let the Dutch govern the Chinese, they were called Kongsis, the Chinese business and politics and religion conglomerates. You can also call them secret societies, maybe. That were very influential in Borneo, and the Dutch authorities had to deal with that. So at the same time that he is preparing for that work as a political and language agent for the Dutch in Borneo, he studies local religion and produces many volumes that are still a major source for us to understand what Taoism is. Now, that is one side, Snoeger-Gronje and De Groot, and what you could call colonial scholarship. And on the other side, you have the theologians and the students of religion, who basically are in the same way as Müller, trying to figure out what religion is at the end of the 19th century and what these different kinds of world religions are. So you cannot anymore just claim Christianity is the only religion and the rest is superstition or heathendom or whatever and has to be converted to Christianity. People are getting aware of a world in which there are parallel major religious traditions that have to be respected. And so the formation of comparative religion, that, in which Müller played an important role, also Thiele at Leiden played an important role, these people were doing that in a more abstract way, as it were, on basis of textual traditions and on sometimes rather ideological ideas about, especially about Islam. It's very interesting how that Buddhism and Hinduism are never seen as a threat and therefore as moral world religions, whereas Islam is really a problem. And it's, of course, also a geopolitical problem, as it is today. And you have, therefore, a very interesting kind of juxtaposition and also partly conversation of people who have practical knowledge in the field, as it were, of Muslim society, of Chinese society. You have the same kind of things also in archaeology and so on. So people who do work in the colonized areas and the more abstract workers who basically have to also deal with theology and Christianity in the home country. So especially Leiden and Amsterdam, also Utrecht, these are very interesting sites for studying that interplay of new knowledge about these colonized areas and theological debates about true religion.
Now, Christians played a formative role on the ground, too, in the form of Christian missionaries. And you outline some of the contours of the debate in terms of what is the location of Christianity in a modern society. How did these debates affect the formulation of Indian and Chinese modernities? How do they take shape in those contexts?
Yeah, missionaries are very important. They bring knowledge, also technical knowledge, to local areas. And they intervene in the understanding of local traditions and so on. They also often, like in India, play a role in formulating something about the downtrodden, say, the untouchables and the tribals and so on, so the marginal people in society. So they are really influential in a very, to put that in a kind of infiltrating way, as it were, at several levels of society, especially at the local level, at the grassroots level. They also attack, they criticize practices, and they say that these practices are immoral and should be changed. And to some extent, they try to influence politically also the colonial governments to change those things. And so there's a kind of always a tension between missionaries and colonial governments. It's a mistake to think of missionaries as just hand in glove with the colonial authorities. That's not the case at all. They are really always in debate and in conflict with the colonial authorities, because authorities just want peace to be able to also do what is economically important, get money out of these places. But they intervene and they deal with local society and with local culture, and people in these local cultures, they want to defend what they are doing, and they feel attacked, and so you get a lot of apologetics in India and in China. You get also, of course, violence. You have the Boxer Revolt at the end of the 19th century in China, killing missionaries in many places. But mostly this is just in a more debating form. And you get all kinds of movements that actually imitate certain kinds of elements are being brought by the missionaries without taking over Christianity. So you find all kinds of movements, both in India and in China, that imitate, for example, educational practices. They start schools and so on, Buddhist schools, all kinds of Hindu schools, basically emulate the success of Christianity to bring a certain kind of modern world. And also what is then called kind of more practical Buddhism or active Buddhism that is very much looking like missionaries in the sense that you want to not only meditate but also do practical work among people, so social welfare work and so on. So health and education are aspects of modernity that are brought by missionaries and are imitated by movements in Islam, Hinduism, Taoism, and so on, and Buddhism.
Now, magic also poses a problem for modernizing projects, I guess we could say. What was the problem with magic for South and East Asians? How did they see its place within modern society? And what were the types of things that, that people were critiquing?
Well, they are critiquing certain kinds of like spirit possession, forms of enthusiasm, as it were, where people lose their rationality, so to say, and forms of magic in the sense of influencing the future through certain ritual practices. The idea of modernizing elites was that the people, say common people, were hindered in becoming modern citizens by their magical practice, by these superstitious practices. They have to become more rational. And they are also fooled. And in these arguments, you find that that element often, that the common people are fooled by priests, and these priests are just getting some personal gain out of fooling commoners. So education is often seen as an answer to this. So the idea that if one educate people, they will become more rational. And then the progress of society, which was lacking in the sense that the West seemed to be more advanced, or was more advanced in many ways, and had to be, one had to catch up, that, say, scientific progress could be stimulated by getting rid of all these magical practices through which people were hindered to see the world as it is. Now, in that you find in a whole range of thinkers and politically activists, people, both in India and China. In China, much stronger than in India, because in India these practices are hierarchical. So people are not so much condemned when they do these practices that are seen as magical and superstitious by elites. These elites see these what they call low practices as inherent to being in such a low position. So it's a kind of socially determined stupidity, as it were. And the Indians have less the idea that one has to be educated out of this. So there is less the sense of a certain kind of equality that has to be reached through a shared rationality. So there you have a difference between India and China, which is still available today.
Now, within these secularizing projects, the material consequences are somewhat different when we look at China and when we look at India. Can you talk about how practices like challenging social roles of religious professionals or questioning the types of activities that happen at so-called religious institutions or these types of things shaped Chinese and Indian secularism?
Yeah, well, in that sense, this China and India are following a very different path. So the Chinese intellectuals have always been very close to the state, and they at the end of the 19th century, they are primarily interested in modernizing, and in a kind of worship of science. Now, within that science, you have a lot of ideas that are actually traditional Chinese. So they also stimulate, for example, traditional medicine. It's interesting that a couple of days ago, someone got the Nobel Prize for Medicine who was connecting science and traditional Chinese medicine. And that is, how does one say that in English? Grist to the mill or something? for the Chinese way of thinking, that one has to actually take the scientific elements out of these traditions. They are, some of these traditions are scientific in themselves. But basically, there is a very strong effort to make a national culture that takes science as its center and connects science to its civilization. Whereas in India, the situation is quite different. I explain that through the fact that it has been colonized by the British. So the major thing of basis of resisting British colonialism was through religious mobilization. Muslim mobilization, Hindu mobilization, these are the major forms of it. And they have to therefore use religion as a source of that mobilization. They do not attack it in the same way as is done in China, where you do not have colonial authorities that are in some way associated with Christianity. You just have modern ideas that are coming from the West. So the nationalism in India has been, from the start, much more strongly influenced by religion. And religion has been much more nationalized, as it were, becoming a national property in India than was the case in China.
Now, you return to ideas about spirituality, but rather than this personal inner experience that many Westerners imagined the East to possess, you talk about it as a political phenomena, and you look at both yoga and qigong and kind of related projects. In thinking about this, what should we consider when constructing a history of this political spirituality in modern Asia and as it blooms abroad?
Yeah, what I try to say is that people have seen indeed spirituality as something that is deeply interior and is often seen also as conservative and or escapist and so on. People also look back at earlier forms of spirituality through the lens of new age and so on. What I try to show is that at the end of the 19th century and continuing in the 20th century, there is a very strong movement that connects anti-colonial politics with an idea of the rich resources of Oriental wisdom, and movements that are socialist and, as I said, anti-colonial, and that connect, therefore, people in the West who are quite radical to people who are formulating nationalist projects in India and China. So that's one element of it. The other element, of course, is, as I said, that people like Vivekananda had reformed understandings of yoga and making yoga into a national element of national culture as the basis of Hinduism and at the same time a contribution to world spirituality. And the movements that were started by Vivekananda become very crucial in Indian nationalism, and also influence in a major way people like Gandhi, who has his own form of understanding of yoga as a resource for, you can say, national regeneration. So they become very political. So this spirituality is not apolitical, it's actually very political, in both in Europe and in America and in, say, the East. Qigong has a very interesting kind of history in that it's basically is stimulated by the Communist Party in the 1950s as part of a cheap medical practice that can be propagated by barefoot doctors, as it were, all over China. China is a very poor country in the 1950s, and basic health care is stimulated through also stimulating traditional Chinese medicine. Now, there's no way you can understand traditional Chinese medicine and also forms of Qigong without having some baggage of religious traditions in it, Taoist and Buddhist traditions. So the communists take, to some extent, something on board, you can say, that that they cannot completely control. And when China opens up a little bit in the 1970s and 80s, this kind of Qigong movement gets an enormous spread through the population. And then at the end, through movements like Falun Gong, become threatening to the Chinese government. And here you have again something which seems totally interior and harmless, just a practices of breathing that are done in groups of people, becoming slowly more and more millenarian and political activists. And so the potential of spiritual movements that have a certain kind of moral vision of the world to serve as a source for political mobilization is very real, and surely in India and China, one of the major elements of political mobilization.
And at the end of the book, you turn to the issue of Muslims in India and China, which, of course, have very different histories in terms of Muslims in these areas. But you look at it more as a question of religious minorities and their relationship to the state. So what do we find when we examine the production of a Muslim minority in relation to a national majority in India and China?
Yeah, what happens, in my view, is that there you get a nationalist view of civilization, and there is then the core civilization that is the basis of the nation that is formulated, say, from the end of the 19th century, and that the major question. When you have a majoritarian nationalism, is what happens with the minorities? How it is going to treat the minorities? Is it going to see as one of the streams that come into that civilizational course, or are they accepted on an equal basis, and so on? Now, That's not happening in majoritarian nationalism in India, and also not in China. Muslims are seen as outsiders and continue to be seen as outsiders, and it becomes more and more a issue whether they belong or not. In India, this is obviously very clear. This is because it also leads then to it has a much stronger political salience because of the numbers and the significance of Islam in South Asia, and then leads to the partition in, between Pakistan and India. That foreigners is directly then related to the existence of Pakistan. Whereas in China, this is much more muted, but becomes very crucial in the relation to Xinjiang. And Xinjiang being basically a late addition to the Qing Empire, and with a very complicated relationship to the core. Now, the attacks basically on Islam in Xinjiang lead to a solidarity that is possible between different groups of Muslims in China that in principle do not have much to do with each other, say Hui Muslims and Kazakhs and so on, and Uyghur. They don't. They are ethnically so divided that Islam doesn't immediately connect them. But through the pressure of the state, and a state that defines itself as a civilizational state in which Muslims are defined as outsiders, you get a phenomenon of minoritization that that is also potentially quite powerful politically.
Now, there's so much more to the book, and many of the examples. You really only scratched the surface, but we've really taken a lot of your time, and we appreciate that. But before we let you go, can you tell us the types of things you're working on now, or the any publications we might look forward to in the near future?
Yeah, I have given the how are they called, the in Rochester, the Morgan Lectures, and they are going to be published in April, I think, in Duke University Press, under the title "The Value of Comparison," in which I try to theoretically more, say, defend my interest in comparison. What I do is, of course, as I said, this is hubris, and really, you eat more than you can swallow, or something. I don't know what, but there must be English expressions like that. And but I still believe that this is an important contribution to getting out of too strong specialization, and which I deplore, which I see how it has happened, but I think that we have to have also an antidote to it. So that's one element, and then basically also defending a more fragmentary approach to social reality than, say, cognitive approaches and universalist cognitive approaches about our universal capacity to know things, and large-scale macro-sociological approaches about, say, What is sometimes done by in political science, these big value surveys. So I try to defend a more anthropological and humanistic approach against what I see as a growing importance of universalist and basically Eurocentric ways of thinking.
Great. Well, we look forward to that. And thanks again for talking about this great book.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That was my conversation with Peter van der Veer about his new book, The Modern Spirit of Asia, The Spiritual and the Secular in China and India, published with Princeton University Press. Thanks again for listening to another episode of New Books in Religion.